You're listening to Disturbing the Priest with Brandon Baddock.
You have such an extensive timeline. How much do you feel your creative process has evolved and just general approach to writing music?
With this one, it was very different. The reason being is because we all, as you would know, we all hit COVID. And I originally set about recording some of the laying the drum tracks for this in 2019. And then, of course, COVID happened and, you know, we had a governmental directive that we all had to stay at home and all that, all the rest of that stuff. So I had a lot of songs that I'd written in the past that was going to be put on this album. And I started looking at those. Unfortunately, I was able to, back in the day, I demoed them and I had drum tracks already on them. So I thought, you know what, I'll use the drum tracks that I have. And then later on, I started writing specifically for this album. You asked me how my writing has evolved. Well, it has, yeah, quite a bit, really, because of the technology that we now have. So, I mean, back in the day, everything was analog rather than digital. And the writing process would be very different than it is these days. Everyone is able to write, and you're able to write in sound bites and then start arranging, which is a lot of the tracks that are on this album. I did just that. We got the, you know, the segments that sounded a bit like a jigsaw puzzle, and they were all individual parts. And I started having a look at the arrangements of them all and then started piecing them together so that the finality of it is that you end up with a song. And that's kind of how it's different. I write on keyboards. I don't play guitar, not at all, much is the pity. I would love to be able to pick up a guitar and say to my guitarist, look, you know, this and this. But unfortunately, I can't do that. I've never learned, and I've got drummer's fingers, so not conducive to playing a guitar. So that's keyboards I write on. Yeah. And much the same as a lot of other stuff as well. You know, just as you're walking the dog or whatever, you start humming something and you put that down and then you come home and kind of start working on it. I take it you're a musician as well.
A little bit. I'm more of like a radio guy. But I do play guitar here and there. I do know a few power chords.
Yeah.
Cool. How long was the record in the works? So you started during COVID.
Yeah, 2019, I laid drum tracks down with a looking at 2020, start laying tracks properly. And I was looking at 2020 release on it. And and then we went into lockdown for how many years was it? Two, three, something like that.
It's all very blurry.
Yeah, it is. It's crazy.
Yeah, very crazy.
Yeah, it was. And we couldn't do stuff. So I was able to just sit at home and work on them at home. Yeah. So
yeah.
The whole process was so long. It just felt as though it went on forever. And not only that, I was learning a lot about, I use Logic Pro. And I was learning at the time all about that. And I had lots of stuff that happened that didn't really need to happen. I would work on a track all day and I would be doing bits and pieces to it. And then save it, or thought what I'd saved it, and come back the following day to open it, and then have these ridiculous messages coming up saying that the files that you're trying to find aren't findable; they've disappeared.
And the worst.
Really? And so, yeah, I learned. It was a long learning process, but yeah, it was all right. It was okay. I got there in the end, so that's the main thing.
Is it, were you using like Pro Tools?
No, Logic.
Logic.
Cool. Yeah.
All right, yeah, Lockdown's great. We got the 2017 release that is fantastic as well, and also the 1984 release. Now, it is interesting the amount of time between the debut and sophomore record. Why was there such a long hiatus?
Because I grew disillusioned with everything. I came over back in the 80s when I had the band together. It was a very different music industry. And I was always searching for that major deal, always trying to find the major deal, you know, chasing that all the time. And it wasn't happening in the UK. And my partner at the time, who was the vocalist, Jody Valentine, she was American. And so we just packed up everything and we came over to the States, over to the East Coast, and went about trying to form an American band and trying to get a deal at the same time. We came pretty close to a few things. We saw Pat Benatar's manager at the time, and it was looking good for a while, but then that all kind of went by the wayside. So then we came back, and I felt as though there was just nothing happening with the band. I just couldn't get the deal that I was after. And so I decided to just kind of stop for a while and kind of have a rethink about it. And the way that it came back was quite strange. I did a remastering of all the early material, Beauty and the Beast and Feel Like Rock and Roll and those tracks. There was out of the blue, a guy contacted me, a guy called Jeremy Golden, who runs a label called Heaven and Hell in the States. And he said to me, have you ever released your back catalogue on you know, digital? And I said, no, not at all. And we spoke and I started thinking about it. And so I spent about a year remastering bit by bit. And that was eventually released as Echoes from the Analog Asylum. I called it that because obviously everything that had gone before it was actually analog. So it made sense that this was the first Thunderstick product that was out digital. And that was okay. I had no intention of putting a live band together or anything like that. It was what it was. And then I got a guy that contacted me and said, did you know that your ex-partner and your ex-singer is in a care-assisted home and has been for the last 5 years?
Wow.
And I was like, what are you talking? And it was Jody. She had got early onset Alzheimer's disease and she was only in her 50s. And he had a copy of Analog, and he was a musician himself. And he used to go and visit these people in the care homes. And he went into the care home and found Jody and played her the album, and she didn't even recognize her own vocal or voice on it. She just sat and looked out the window. And in no time at all, she died because of it was an Alzheimer's related illness, whatever it was. And there were a lot of tracks that I had that we'd performed live and had been demoed, but had never reached masters. So I thought, you know what, this is the right time to actually go ahead and go and record them for real. So I did just that, and that's what Something Wicked This Way Comes. That's how that came about.
Wow.
Yeah, it was due to the receiving that news. I found the guy that whose studio I was using. He said, we used to go to school together, and he was the one that instigated it and said, look, you know, why don't you do this? And I said, well, I haven't got a vocalist and I don't know how I go about doing it. And he said, right, well, I'll put an advert out. I'll put a shout out and we'll see if somebody comes together. So that's how I ended up using Lucy V. And it was purely only as a session. There was no intention of actually putting it together live. And yeah, the reviews that I got on it were pretty good. So when everybody started coming back with positives, I sat back and thought, oh, maybe I should do this, and we should put a vocal, put a live band together, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And here we are. Yeah, very, very cool to hear, and unfortunately tragic as well.
But
it definitely adds something to that record, and I'll definitely listen to it with new ears.
The ballad that's on the end of it is I Close My Eyes, which is my homage to Jody.
Wow. Yeah, that makes sense.
We've done it on this. We've done a different version on this latest album, of which I've added strings to it and what have you. I'm really, really pleased with the way that it sounds on this album. So
fantastic song. Very good song. Now, you are the most iconic drummer in new wave of British heavy metal. I think that's obvious. I'd love to know, as a drummer, what was your first exposure to the sticks?
Very strange.
Oh, yeah?
It was like, I always used to be drawn to the drummer watching television, you know, when I was a young kid. And my uncle started collecting for what you guys would call a garage sale, a garage sale.
Yeah, yard sale, too.
We called it a jumble sale over here. So somebody threw out a pair of military drumsticks that were like, you know, like that. And I started beating, instead of putting them into the sale, I kept them and started beating up on my parents' furniture. And they didn't like that much. So I was nine when they got me a kit. And I started just trying to mess about and play on the kit. It was crazy because they buy you a kit and they go, there you go, there's a kit, you can play that. And then the neighbors start complaining about the noise, and then they come and tell you stop playing because the neighbors are complaining. I didn't get that at all. I couldn't understand it. But that's when it first kicked in.
Yeah. Very interesting. And those sticks, I assume, are long gone.
Long gone.
Yeah. Those are some iconic drumsticks.
Yeah,
if anyone ever finds them. Wow. So you have plenty of influences. At what age were you first exposed to like your biggest influences?
Quite early. I had an art teacher who looked not too dissimilar to yourself. he had hair down, this is quite a long time ago now, and he had hair down to his waist, and he brought in a it would be called a record player because that's what it was. It was like a Dansett thing. And he asked everybody whilst we were doing our art to come in and play, bring some albums in, and we'll play the albums. And at that early age, the very first album I bought was an album by the Moody Blues called In Search of the Lost Chord. And I loved that album because there was so much on it. There was so much richness. There were the layers on it. And my favorite instrument, a mellotron. I loved the mellotron. Yeah. But in the art class, that was when I heard Grand Funk for the very first time. And I heard Frank Zappa for the very first time. And,
wow.
Who else was there? Yeah, there were a number of different, bands that I'd never heard before. Jefferson Airplane, as they were, rather than Starship. And, all those kind of, was an album called Bathing at Baxter's? Was that Jefferson Airplane?
I am not 100% sure. I recognize that title, though. It might be. Yeah.
And also from school as well, that we used to kind of, my friend and I used to go into school and sign the register to say that you were in for the day, and then you go straight back out the school gates and jump on the bus. And because our parents were already at work, we could go back and listen to albums, So we used to listen to The Nice, which was a precursor to Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And then, of course, Zeppelin II would have been around that time. And the Rolling Stones, especially the Rolling Stones at that time, you know, listening to things like Beggar's Banquet and what have you. Great albums,
very good.
And I just still have great thoughts of, you know, memories of those times, which were really, really good. And you're like a sponge at that age; you just take on so much, and it was great.
Yeah. Wow. So I know you also went to work in a recording studio. How did working at Pi shape you to be the musician you are today?
Well, it was frustrating because I kind of persevered. You know, we used to get a careers advisor that would come around to the school, and he would say, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be in the music business. And the most that they could offer me was, you know, probably putting in an application or a job, try and get an interview with a local record store. And it was like, no, you know, I want to actually be in the industry. And of course, at that time, they had no way of being able to follow that up. So I took it upon myself that I just wrote to every studio in London. And as you say, I got offered the job at Pi.
Wow.
And it was an eye-opener, but I was also very frustrated because at that time I was starting to get really serious about my playing. And I spent all the time, you know, in the control room making coffees and being a tape op and you know, that sort of stuff. And I would look through the glass at these bands, early status quo. They'd been a pop band before, and then they came back as everybody knows, a kind of 12 bar, you know, boogie type thing. And I was tape hopping on one of their first albums. They had an album called Dog of Two Head, and I was tape hopping on that. But it was so frustrating to be seeing these bands, and I can remember a band called Stone the Crows that had Maggie Bell as a singer. And they came in and they did a night session, and all they did was just got wrecked and just were jamming and playing and all that. And there's me as a young kid, you know, impressionable kid, thinking all that studio time that they're just wasting, you know, and you know, you think that they would be dying to get in there and create. And I couldn't understand it. And so that's what led me to leave in the end, because I wanted to play more than I wanted to record the band's playing. So
that makes sense. So it was just like a huge tease, pretty much, because you were just sitting there and you're like, I wish I could be a part of that. You ended up playing in a few bands that were like more on like the glam side, if I believe. That was definitely one of the reasons that made you like one of the more theatrical performers, right?
Yeah. I joined a band. There was a band that I was in called Tiny and the Hot Toddies. And we did, there was a big festival that used to take place in London. And it was an illegal festival. What it was all these trucks would just turn up with generators and everything. And it would take place in Windsor Park, which is one of the Queen's residence, you know, not Buckingham Palace, but in Windsor, there's the Windsor Castle, and it has these great big palatial grounds. And around that time, there would be all these trucks that turn up, and it went on for a week, this festival.
Wow.
And it would have Hawkwind and Pink Fairies and all these kind of real psychedelic type of bands.
Oh.
And I was in a band playing Tiny and the Hot Toddies, and we did the gig, and it was great. And then we packed everything up, and one by one the various trailers started closing down for the day, and there was only one left running, and that was the one that we had played on. And somebody came back and said, would you like to go on again and do another set, because you know there are still people out there that really want to hear some music. So we went back on, and this guy turns up afterwards and he says to me, Hi, my name's Simon. I sing for a band called The Primitives. The Primitives are a band that went out in the 60s out into Italy, had a great big following in Italy. Had a guy who was singing for him called Mal. And Mal and The Primitives had gone their separate ways. Mal had gone on to become a great solo artist, and The Primitives had gone really more rocky. And he said, if you and the guitarist, because we're after a drummer and we're after a guitarist, if you want to come out, that would be great. And we thought, yeah, of course, this is really going to happen. And anyway, it did. It happened. And we went out there. And as you're right in saying, we were real glam. You know, this is 1974.
Wow.
And we ended up living and moving to Sicily. and you know, can you imagine Sicily in 1974? These Sicilian guys after church on a Sunday would come out, and if we were out where we were living, because we moved into a huge great big farm, and it was, the farm itself was made out of solidified lava rock, and there was no electricity, no water, there was a well. And but good thing about it was that we were able to run some electricity so we could rehearse. And the Sicilians must have thought that we dropped out of space, because we looked so, because at the time glam was really happening over here. David Bowie was doing his Ziggy Stardust thing, and you know, there were loads of glam bands. And can you imagine what Italians and Sicilians made of us? I'm surprised that we never got shot. But we toured relentlessly all over Italy, Sicily, Sardinia, wow, Greece, and it was great. For me, it was a real eye opener. I mean, living on the banks of Mount Etna was just something else. You know, it was really good.
What an insane memory. To have. What a really amazing memory to have. You were in so many amazing bands, and you joined Maiden through like an advert.
Yeah.
Right.
I did. When I came back from Sicily, I started my own band called Oz. And I joined a band that was an electric folk band called Archer. And the bass player and I really, really hit it off. And it was good. It was really good, because they'd never had a drummer before. They'd had a guy that played congas. And I joined and sort of changed the direction. But it wasn't going anywhere. The bass player and myself really hit it off. We became good friends. We left and started a band called Oz. Same thing. We could never find the guitarist. Found a keyboard player that was great. And the three of us would rehearse every weekend, but I couldn't find the guitarist. And I was really kind of, by the end of it, I was really frustrated because having done everything that I'd done in Italy, I was expecting to come back, stupid, I know, but I was expecting to come back and get straight into a band that was going to be able to offer me the same kind of life that I had led out there. And of course it didn't happen. So then I saw this advert. There used to be a music publication called Melody Maker. And Melody Maker was the Bible for all musicians that were either looking for a band or bands that were looking for musicians. And I saw this advert, and they were advertising for a keyboard player and a drummer. And it looked as though it was just, you know, a little bit more serious than any of the other things that I had looked at. And that was it. Yeah, it was Iron Maiden. And wow. I ended up going along, and along with so many other drummers. I can remember it was a really hot day when they held the auditions, and I can remember a huge great big long corridor full of guys that were all going, you know, with their drumsticks and ready and the door at the end of the corridor opened up, you know, and it was almost like a finger that came out and went next. it wasn't quite as dramatic as that, but
very
it was
fitting.
It was kind of like that. And I went in and played, and that was it. I ended up getting offered the job, and hey ho.
And you were in it for 8 months, right? Eight months.
Now,
not too long, but do you have like any favorite memories from being in that band, or any moments that stand out?
I you're probably fully aware of the fact that every interview that I ever do, I get asked so many questions about my time with Maiden. The stock questions that I get asked are, one, did you know that they were going to become the biggest heavy metal band in the world? And my answer to that, my stock answer to that was no. It was work in progress. And they were just like every other band out there trying to do it for themselves and trying to get out there and get some work. Because you've got to think about that, up until then, we had been absolutely, there had been a complete deluge of punk bands.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what gave birth to New Woban, but I presume you'll want to ask me that about that anyway. But but with Maiden, yeah, I didn't know that they were going to be as big as they were. Steve Harris introduced me to rehearsing both bass and drums only. The other bands that I'd rehearsed with, we had full band rehearsals. They were never just bass and drums. So that was really good. That was different because of the way that we can see now, you know, time tells us that his whole thought on that was that to make the bass and drums absolutely super, super tight. And so that was that. Did you ever fall asleep whilst on stage with Iron Maiden? No, I didn't fall asleep whilst I was on stage with Iron Maiden. Yet again, it's completely fictitious. And I had some good memories of them. I never felt really part of they were a very serious band, and a lot of the bands that I'd been in beforehand always knew how to have a laugh as well, whereas I found Maiden to be very serious, and more for me for not realizing that with the seriousness becomes the elevation of the band. So that's probably why they are the biggest band in the world, because they're quite serious about what they do. They probably have their moments, but I always felt that it was very serious. Also, I was a Southeast Londoner. There's lots of suburbs to London, and I was born on the south side. Iron Maiden, as everyone knows, comes from the east end of London. So for me, it would always be like crossing over to, it had a huge significance, crossing over the River Thames over to the east end. I always felt as though I was in a kind of completely different territory that I was used to. So it was always, we used to rehearse over there all the time, and you know, most of the gigs that we did were over there as well. So yeah, it was a great time. What can I say? You know, there are so many stories about my time with Maiden that, you know, I kind of just, I try and skirt around the answers these days.
Yeah, it's probably, it is a blip in your timeline, you know, yeah, 8 months. So I had to ask.
Oh, it's a classic. Not for a minute am I having a go at you. No, not at all.
It's all right. So the Survivors record.
Uh-huh.
One of the first ever new wave of British heavy metal records.
Yeah.
So we were talking about Maiden. What was your relationship with the rest of the new wave of British heavy metal bands back in the day? Because there were quite a lot starting up.
Yeah. As I said, up until then, there had been this huge flow of punk bands. And I still really think that, you know, just as a side thought, Steve Harris always says that he absolutely gained nothing from punk whatsoever. But I think that that's not true, because punk had the energy. It had the attitude and it had the energy. Up until then, there had been what we consider to be dinosaur rock bands, you know, such as Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin and what have you, all those great bands, you know. But they were, when punk came along, they were kind of pushed aside, and punk had this just completely different attitude. But with the punk bands that lasted the distance, the full distance, there was a lot of dross as well. And record labels were signing them, and you would get promoters who only wanted to put on punk bands on local gigs, because they knew that they would get people through the door. They didn't want to experiment on any other kind of music. So there was an underground movement of rock bands that had always looked to their, you know, had looked to their predecessors with those dinosaur bands, for want of a better terminology, but they had taken in the energy from punk as well. And that was what became the new wave of British heavy metal, because everybody stayed at home and learned how to play their instruments properly. And and then suddenly there was this new movement. So we were aware of it. We were always aware of it, because you would be on the circuit at last. You were getting gigs, and promoters were putting bands together, and there would be little packages. I mean, with Samson, the package we went out with was I can't remember what the package was called. I can't remember. But it was Angel Witch opening, Iron Maiden in the middle, and Samson headlining. So we were a three-piece with Survivors. That was a really good time for me, because I got to play with John McCoy. John McCoy being the bass player from Gillan, Ian Gillan's band. Great bass player. And I came in to audition for Samson. It wasn't really an audition, because Paul and I were in different bands, and we used to use this one place to rehearse at, and our paths would cross all the time. You know, we maybe finished rehearsing and we were going home, and his band was coming in, or vice versa. And so when I walked through the door, he went, "Oh my God, you." And I went, "Ah, you." And that's how I got gig with Samson.
Wow.
But the first kind of audition that I did was with Chris Aylmer, the bass player. And then they asked me back for a second one, and John McCoy was there. And, you know, I don't know if you know John McCoy, but a massive, great guy. You know, at the time, he was about 19, 20 stone, bald head, great big fur coat he had on. And we did this one track called 6 Foot Under. And it's a kind of weird track, because you can hear it and feel it two ways. One on the on beat, one on the off beat. So you have to make sure that you can hear it the proper way. And he was about that far away from me, standing there going like this, right in my face. And I thought, you know what? I'm not going to let this guy intimidate me. And then that's how Survivors came about, because he played bass on the album and he produced it.
Wow.
Really great for me. It was great. A great, it was a school of rock for me. He taught me so much.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask about the writing recording process of that record. But that's really interesting to hear. How much like studio time did you get?
10 days.
10 days. Very typical.
And that was including mixing as well.
Wow.
It was recorded. Some of it was written on the fly. There's a track called Cause, which came about just out of a jam. We'd finished recording one song, and John and I just sort of took off on something, and we kind of elongated it and made it into a track, an instrumental track. But it was 10 days to get it down and mix it and get it done.
Was it a good budget?
No, it was frighteningly. I mean, most of the budget probably went on John's producer's fees.
Probably.
But it was a silly budget. Came out on an independent label, but they promoted it, and we went and did. Oh, that was it. The Heavy Metal Crusade. That was it. How could I forget? That was the name of the tour that we did as a three piece, and then, you know, we had quite a bit of interest. CBS at the time, which is now Sony, they were asking, they were interested, came to see a couple of shows and said, "I think what you need to do is you need to go and get a vocalist and have a focal point on the front. That will enable your guitarist to actually concentrate more on playing rather than having to sing as well." And that was when enter Mr. Bruce Dickinson.
Yeah, very famously. So very, very interesting. And I feel like every single band from this movement, especially the early stuff, it was just terrible budget. They had, I know Jaguar had like 5 days in the studio. like just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's so much better now where you can boot up your computer. You can take as long as you want.
There you go.
But the thing is, you are everything, you know, which is stressful, I feel. So the Thunderstick persona is very iconic. Where did this come about? What was the defining moment where you became Thunderstick on stage? Do you remember your first show as Thunderstick?
I don't know if it was the first show. I can't remember, but I can remember as to why it came about. And that was because up until then, there had been no magazines, no kind of, there's nothing like Circus or Burn or, you know, Kerrang or anything like that. It was always black and white, what we used to call rags, which were music rags, once a week, Melody Maker being one of them, Sounds being another. And there were never any pictures of the bands or whatever. And if you did, you saw the singer kind of doing his stuff at the front and the guitarist pulling poses. And then you'd see a row of cymbals on the top of somebody's head. And that was the drummer. And there were exceptions to the rule because, you know, people like Keith Moon from The Who and Ian Paice and John Bonham and, you know, the drummers that people remember. But most of the time, if you would say to a fan, Who's the drummer? What's the name of the drummer? They go, I don't know. And so I thought, you know what? I create a faceless drummer. And that's exactly what I did. And I couldn't call it my name. I called it Thunderstick. And it was a very stark image. The Thunderstick image within Samson was very stark. Thick black grease paint around my mouth and around my eyes to bring out and accentuate the whites of the eyes and the teeth. And unfortunately for me at the time, there was a guy that was going around and breaking into women's homes that got labeled as being called, he came to the area that he was doing all this. He was raping women in their own home. In an area called Cambridge, and he became known nationally throughout all the national newspapers as the Cambridge rapist.
Oh no.
And guess what he wore?
Oh no.
Yes. Oh yes. And also, you know, at the time, women's emancipation was really, really quite a strong movement. And because of my image, the huge great posters of my fight or the Thunderstick image, the stark image, they would be outside gigs and they'd rip the posters down and all that. And we had all these protesters outside the gigs, which was crazy. It really was, because I always viewed Thunderstick, the character, as a kind of knockabout character. All right, he was crazy. But it wasn't unlike Alice and Alice. You know, there was the Alice Cooper off stage, but there was the Alice Cooper on stage. And that's how I view Thunderstick. But sooner or later, the two, both my lives, my life as myself and the life as Thunderstick started to, the lines started to kind of merge a little bit. And it was getting a bit strange because I would black up and put on my mask on, you know, when we pulled up outside wherever it was that we were playing. I was checking into hotels like it. Even support bands didn't know what I looked like. It was a bit like Kiss, you know, in the early days, Kiss. Nobody knew what Kiss looked like. And it was much the same thing with me. You know, the support bands would never know. And it was strange because on a couple of occasions, they would be, after the gig, I would be, you know, standing at the bar with Paul or Chris, and you'd get people coming up and talking to them, and they'd say, "Where's Thunderstick?" And he'd go, "Ah, oh, he's just bloke's loony. He's run off into the night screaming, you know, God knows where he is." And of course, I'd be standing right next to them and just, you know, listening to the conversation. So it was quite crazy. Yeah, the crazy times. But I think I can't remember the first gig. It might well have been the Music Machine with with Maiden and Angel Witch. I don't know. I can't swear to
that. Wow. Was that the one the journalist went to of Sounds magazine?
That's the one that no. So it must have been. Yes, it was. It was. He did come to that gig, but it may not have been that first time that I appeared as Thunderstick. But that was definitely the first time that they coined the phrase "new wave of British heavy metal."
Yeah, that which is very cool. Which must feel amazing, you know, yeah, like being a key part of that movement.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, you know, because I got the front cover of Sounds, and that day I think I was in London, and it was really kind of weird walking down the platform of a train station, and there were news agents, and they had, you know, copies of Sounds. And I would walk down there, and I'd look at me, I'd go, oh my God, that's me. Yeah.
Yeah. No one knows, though.
No, nobody knew.
Yeah. So was this the same idea with the Head On album cover?
Yeah.
Where it's like, let's give the drummer the spotlight.
Yeah, the record label did that. It wasn't of our choosing. Head On, the original idea that we had for Head On was either it was a similar shot to who was it that used the two cars up like that that had hit Head On.
Isn't that a Crocus record?
Yeah, Crocus. That was it. Yeah. We had an idea similar to that, or the other idea that we wanted was taken on the top of a building and the ground rushing up at you like that, as if you launched yourself off of the top of the building. And we were thinking of along that, you know, that would be a good idea. But with the Thunderstick image, the label thought that it was just too good an opportunity to miss, and that's how that Head On came about, and they were able to really sell it on the back of that. And it was, you know, it was a strange times, because obviously when Bruce joined the band, he was the focal point for Samson, so he's the man out the front. Paul, whose name is Paul Samson, so it was his band, but Thunderstick was the guy that was getting all the press and everything else. So there were three of us. The only one that wasn't in contention was Chris Aylmer, the bass player. You know, he was the only one that didn't actually feature in any way. You know, so it was, although, you know, we didn't really have egos, the three of us. But I mean, in the end, Thunderstick was my downfall, because Paul and Bruce, we got to a stage when Shock Tactics had been recorded that they wanted to be spoken about and written about as a band, and wanted the material to be taken seriously. And Kerrang was out by then, and Paul and Bruce did an interview with one of the journalists, I think it was Dante Benuto, and they said, look, can we just talk about the music instead of asking me what Thunderstick had for breakfast? You know, do we really need to know all that? And sure. Well, that'd be great. And when the article came out, every single paragraph had a tiny little picture of the Thunderstick mask all the way down.
Wow.
And he'd obviously gone back and deliberately had written about Thunderstick, and that led to a lot of kind of altercations between the three of us. And Bruce and Paul turned around and said, you know, to hell with all this theatrical, because we used to use a lot of pyros as well, and they said, to hell with all this theatricality, we don't want to do that anymore. And they went on stage with Bruce was wearing a rugby shirt and Paul was wearing jeans, and I was really alienated, you know, by the image itself. And that was it. I, you know, that was the beginning of the end, really. Not only that, but with Head On, my playing was at its most adventurous, and it was, you know, at my most spontaneous and extroverted. Whereas when we did Shock Tactics with Tony Platt, the producing it, Tony Platt had been working with AC/DC. They'd just done, I think it was Back in Black, and he'd been working with them. And so we went in, we had a whole, the whole album written, and we went in and did 2 weeks of pre-production where he pulled everything apart and we had to rebuild each track that became Shot Tactics. And
wow.
If you listen, you're listening to my drumming on Shot Tactics and you listen and you compare it to Head On, they are as if they're different drummers.
Yeah.
Because I mean, he pulled so much apart. No, 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 don't do that there. How about if you just go, boom, 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 you know, rather than or whatever. And so all my flamboyant roles kind of went and what have you. And then there's a you know, a dichotomy as to which band people like. Do they like the Samson of Shock Tactics or do they like the Head On Shock Tactics? And then of course Shock Tactics was remixed and mixed with when Bruce joined Maiden, they put it out as Head Tactics for the American market. And they dumbed my drumming down even more, you know, and it was just horrendous. But there you go. Such is life. So.
Yeah, such is life. which, you know, that definitely probably gave you enough motivation to start your own thing.
Yeah, it did.
With Thunderstick,
I did. But, you know, in between then, I joined with Bernie Tormey for a little while. And I was part of Electric Gypsies, not for long, because the press realized that the guy that was playing drums with Bernie was Thunderstick without the mask on. And so they started writing all that in Melody Maker and sounds and what have you. And Bernie didn't want anything like, you know, to be, didn't really want to be associated with that kind of thing.
And yeah.
So I did a tour with Bernie and I did a couple of radio shows that we went in and recorded some stuff. And because I'd done some stuff with him and John McCoy as a three piece whilst I was with Samson and whilst the two of them were with Gillan, we'd gone out and done a couple of shows as McCoy, Thunderstick and Tormey, which was great, you know, really, really good.
Yeah.
But I mean, it all kind of changed, and I thought, you know, I wanted to go down that theatrical route, and I put a female vocalist in there because twofold, really, because I enjoyed having I really wanted to have a female at the front because there weren't many rock bands that had a female vocalist. There were all female bands like Rock Goddess and Girls School and bands like that, but there were no male orientated bands with a female vocalist. And not only that, but because of the trouble that I'd had with all the women's lib activists, I thought if I got a female vocalist at the front and they come looking for me, I can turn around, look, go and talk to her, go and ask her voice. You know, ask
very
her
smart.
Ask her if she feels as though she's, you know, much maligned in a male band or whatever. So
Yeah, so you must look back at the writing of that record very fondly then, because you probably had like just complete control. How was that like finally just having your own project?
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah.
But having to find the finance for it was not so cool. You know, it's always been a struggle. It really has. But yeah. I managed to find the finance to do the four-track EP. And I took off and went to Europe to try and find some management and what have you. And I saw a few people like Golden Earrings manager when we were in Holland. And that was interesting. And I thought, oh man, you know, maybe we can get this, but it didn't happen. So it was all again about trying to find the major label, but it just didn't happen. We put it out on an indie label again. And it was hard. It's really hard to try and keep a band together when you've got other musicians going, well, you know, what are we doing? Are we going to be able to rehearse? Are we going to be able to afford to be able to rehearse or what? Yeah, it was hard. But it was at the same time, it was great to have my own band.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've almost come full circle. Now we're back to Thunderstick.
Yeah.
And, you know, the three records are fantastic.
Thank you.
What's the future looking like for Thunderstick?
I want to. We went to Poland last year, and we're going back next year. But we recorded it, and I'm looking at trying to put together another. I put a live album together.
Fantastic.
I've got 24 track of those, so that would be good. That's my next little thing to start looking at. Try and promo as much as possible the new album. I've had good reaction to it, which is really good. That's nice. I like the fact that it runs at an hour and 20, so it's a double length album for the price of a single album, and it's been fun doing. I've got a lot of friends on it, and that's great. And that was purely because of COVID, and I had a couple of guitarists that were kind of. They were getting a little bit bored at sitting around, so they kind of jumped ship. And I asked a lot of people if they could recommend anybody that had the Thunderstick criteria, as it were, the way that they look or and the way they play. But nobody was forthcoming. But the friends that I contacted turned around and said, I can't recommend anybody, but I would love to play on your album. And that's exactly what happened. I used a lot of friends on it, people like a guy called Dave John Ross, who played for a New Orleans band called Moore. And really, really good.
Wow.
Ex-Thunderstick guitarist as well, a guy called Dave Kilford, who was on the Something Wicked album. So it's been really, really good. And now I've got an amazing singer. I think she is wonderful.
Fantastic.
She has such stage presence as well. So our shows are getting a little bit more crazy now, so that we're kind of putting together shows that will encompass tracks from the new album. Plus, I'm trying out a couple of different Samson tracks as well. I played
Cool.
this afternoon, and I've taken another track. We already do Riding with the Angels and Earth Mother. But I've taken another one from the Shock Tactics album, and I'm looking at that, which will be good.
Cool, very exciting. And yeah, it is a long record lockdown, but it's so consistently good.
Thank you.
So
That's
looking
great.
forward to
Thank
hear
you,
more
Frank.
of it live. Yeah. So as we wrap up here, I just have a couple things I'm curious about. Now, the new wob or whatever is a huge movement in just the evolution of the genre of heavy metal. Of course, thrash came after that, and I guess death metal. What's your opinion on where that genre went, like the evolution of heavy metal since then?
Well, yeah, as you said, diversity.
Yeah.
More than anything else, you get doom metal, and you get thrash, and you get mask metal, and there are just so many diverse genres of that have come out of that. I kind of I'm a little bit I'm stuck in the middle because I don't actually regard Thunderstick Band as a true heavy metal band. I don't think we are dirty enough in our arrangement. I'm much more of a power rock band. It's all encompassing, isn't it? It's you can't say, oh, well, I'm no longer heavy metal, and you divorced yourself from that, because it is all very much intertwined, aren't they? But I don't think that I'm an out and out metal band. More so hard rock, but
Yeah.
the diversity is good, isn't it? I mean, anything that gives that amount of difference and the amount of pleasure that people derive from it is great. I think it is really, really good.
It's very, very good. This has been awesome talking to you. What's the best way for people to just stay updated with all your projects and everything you do?
I would say at the moment, Facebook more than anything else. If you go on to either mine, Barry Graham Purkis, or just put in Thunderstick Facebook, and then we have our fan page as well, the Thunderstick Stormtroopers. So anything there, and then you will get all the links to everything else from that. So
Great. Fantastic. Thank you so much for doing this, man. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you, Brandon.
I'm Brandon Baddock, and this is Disturbing the Priest.